From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we look at troubled efforts to recruit and train Iraqi security forces and plans to quell the growing sectarian violence in Baghdad with Michael Gordon, chief military correspondent for The New York Times. He's just returned from Iraq. We'll also discuss the 2003 invasion and the early days of occupation, the subject of Gordon's book with co-author Bernard Trainer, Cobra 2, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Another Fine Day, the fourth album by the band Golden Smog, made up of moonlighting rockers from other bands. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. While much of the world's attention since mid-July has focused on Lebanon, violence in Iraq has continued to increase. Iraqi civilian deaths have averaged over 3,000 a month, and the pace of the killing is still rising. My guest, Michael Gordon, is chief military correspondent for the New York Times. He recently returned from Iraq, where he's written about plans to try and stem the violence in Baghdad. Gordon has a story in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine on efforts to recruit and train Iraqi security forces in a province that's a hotbed of insurgent attacks. Michael Gordon and retired Marine General Bernard Traynor co-authored the book Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. Well, Michael Gordon, welcome to Fresh Air. In this week's Sunday Times Magazine, you talk about the efforts of the United States forces to recruit and train Iraqi soldiers in the province of Anbar. Tell us where Anbar province is and its significance in the insurgency.
Well, the Al-Anbar province is essentially western Iraq, and it's really the most dangerous region in the country on a per capita basis and the most dangerous area outside of Baghdad. So we're talking about a vast region, probably the size of Louisiana, that includes places Americans have heard of, unfortunately, places like Fallujah, Ramadi, Haditha. These are all headline towns because of the fighting and the difficulties there. And it's a largely Sunni region, so it means it's a place which has become a bit of a sanctuary and a base for the insurgency.
You write, of course, that if there is a viable exit strategy for the United States in Iraq, it depends upon developing security forces among Iraqis themselves. And you write that a number of the Iraqi army battalions there in Anbar were under strength, some by as much as 50% or more at times. Why?
Well, I went to Anbar and embedded as a correspondent. It was my first time back in Iraq, by the way, since 2003. And I was embedded with the Marine teams that are training the new Iraqi army. And I was in Haditha, in the Haditha Triad, which includes places like Heat and Barwana and also Fallujah. And the development of the Iraqi army and also the Iraqi police really is the United States exit strategy. I mean, that's the position of President Bush, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. I mean, the idea is there's a recognition on the part of the American government that the insurgency is not going to be defeated in any reasonable period of time. So the strategy at this point is to transfer as much responsibility as possible to these new Iraqi security forces so that they can assume the lead in carrying on this fight, which is going to last for some time. But one of the principal problems is just manning levels, troop levels. The Iraqi army simply doesn't have enough soldiers in Anbar, certainly not enough to substitute for American troops. And I'll give you an example. There are two divisions of Iraqi troops in Anbar, the 7th Division, which is the most recent of the 10 divisions in the Iraqi army, and the 1st Division. And I was with both of them. But in the Haditha area, which is a very hot area, meaning there's a lot of fighting and activity and a lot of IEDs being planted, the battalion I saw there, the 227, they have an authorized strength of in excess of 700, meaning they're supposed to have about 750 guys. And indeed, at one time last fall, they had about 700. Well, the current number is 400. Apart from the fact that that's a very small number, the trend was not encouraging. I mean, they had started out at 700, and now they're down to 400. And one of the points I raised in the Times Magazine piece is, what kind of exit strategy is this when the Iraqis are exiting faster than we are?
What happened to the other 300?
They went AWOL. They never came back. I mean, there's a practice in the Iraqi army, which dates back to Saddam's period, where about a third of the force is, a quarter to a third is on leave at any one time. What happens is they pay the troops, and because there's no kind of decent banking system in the country, the soldiers get in buses and go home to deliver their pay. And since most of the Iraqi army is really made up of Shia, not of Sunnis, in the 7th Division, it's overwhelmingly Shia, These people have to go back to Basra, Nasiriyah, and Najaf, parts of Baghdad, basically Shia areas that are far from Anbar. And, you know, a lot of them vote for with their feet. They collect their pay, they go home, and they just don't come back again. First of all, Anbar is a dangerous area. Second of all, there have been all sorts of problems in just getting them paid properly by a dysfunctional Iraqi Ministry of Defense. And, you know, there are some other things they can do. They can become policemen in their local communities. Now, they think they've stopped the slide. And actually, while I was there, the number increased of this battalion from 350 to 400. But that's still far fewer than the 700 it started out with last fall.
Let me get this straight. They pay soldiers in cash, and then the soldiers get on buses and physically have to take that cash back to their families hundreds of miles away?
Right. That's the system. That's how it's always been done. It doesn't, there's no wire transfers of funds or other mechanism for paying them. So, yes, they physically hand these people their pay. They sign a receipt for it. At least they did with the unit in Haditha. And then once a month, they get on buses. They get a 10-day leave in this battalion, and they're bused to Al-Asad, and then they get on another series of buses and eventually make their way all the way down to where their families are, which could be as far as Basra, hand off the pay, spend a little time with their families, and head on back. That's the system, and it's not desirable for a lot of reasons, but one reason is the insurgents attack a lot of these leave convoys.
You mentioned that in addition to the tremendous danger that these Iraqi soldiers face if they enlist in the Iraqi army, there are problems with the logistics, simply getting them paid and fed. Talk about that a little bit. Are we talking about corruption or incompetence or both?
Well, you know, the Iraqi army is a kind of a project, you know, that's still underway. But one of the things that the American commanders are trying to do now is help the Iraqis develop their own logistical system so the United States doesn't have to stay there forever and support them. I mean, you know, to provide the fuel and the food and the water and the spare parts and the Humvee tires and the mine clearing equipment and the whole panoply of stuff that makes an army run. So the National Logistics Contract is really being shifted over to the Iraqis. A lot of this happened in June. But what's apparent is they're not quite up to it at this point in time. So some of the food and that gets out to Anbar, which is, you know, can be quite a distance from the Baghdad area, is spoiled. Spare parts don't always arrive. The unit I was with got IED'd. I was with them when they were hit by one of these roadside bombs. It was a gory scene. One of the Iraqi soldiers was killed. Three were wounded. The next day we went out on another patrol. And one of the things that the Iraqis and the Marines trainers were trying to scrounge up was some mine detecting equipment. Well, the Iraqi supply system didn't provide it. That's a pretty important piece of equipment if you're going on a dirt road. And as it turned out, we had to do without it. They just couldn't find any. The Marines are going to try to give them some of their own now. So these are some of the deficiencies, and they add to the strain on the force in Anbar.
One of the interesting parts of the piece in this Sunday's Times was where you went to the barracks of the troops in Anbar and had some conversations with them about what the conditions they face. What did they tell you?
Yeah, I had pretty free rein, and I was embedded for quite a while. I was out there almost a month all in all. And so a few nights I would go over to the in the Haditha area. This is really in the shadow of the Haditha Dam. It's a surrealistic place. You got to imagine a 10-story Soviet-style dam towering over everything in an area that is just quite a violent area, a lot of opposition to an American presence, the scene also of these allegations of atrocities that have played heavily in the American media. But I would go over to this Iraqi camp and meet with the Jundi. The Jundi is what is the Iraqi name for soldiers. And they would talk completely freely about the problems. The one thing they were insistent on was that their names not be used. Same thing the officers made the same point. The officers were concerned that the insurgents would somehow identify them and assassinate them, which is a genuine fear. Soldiers were concerned that the Iraqi Ministry of Defense would retaliate against him. But what the soldiers said was that a lot of times they don't get paid properly. For example, there are a bunch of guys who were being paid as trainees, but they were full-fledged jundi. They should have been getting soldier pay. Or you'll have one of the things the Americans are trying to do is build a non-commissioned officer corps of sergeants and corporals and have them take on responsibility. Well, there are people who are promoted to these ranks, but then they're just paid as privates. This is a big problem, and it's partly due to kind of a very confused and system that the Iraqi Ministry of Defense has in Baghdad. This is all done by hand. It's not automated. It's a very inefficient system. But basically, you have guys who are not paid according to rank. Sometimes they don't get paid at all. I mean, I met there was a lieutenant who hadn't been paid for 6 months. That's not so uncommon.
My guest is Michael Gordon. He is military correspondent for the New York Times. He is also co-author with retired Marine General Bernard Traynor of the book Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Michael Gordon. He is chief military correspondent for the New York Times. He has a piece in this Sunday Times magazine about efforts to train Iraqi military forces in the province of Al-Anbar. Apart from the problems of spoiled food and pay that's late or doesn't get there, how did the soldiers feel about the mission that they were undertaking and their chances of success?
Well, the soldiers I was with are soldiers who are still there despite all the dangers and hardships, so it's a bit of a self-selected group. But I did meet Iraqi commanders and Iraqi soldiers who seemed reasonably dedicated to the task. They certainly put up with a lot of dangers. They're getting armored Humvees, but they don't have the same quality of armored Humvees as the Americans. They don't have quite all the kit that the Americans have, and yet they share the same risks and sometimes are really in greater risk because they're a prime target for the insurgents. So I met people who were dedicated to their mission. You know, they take a very long view of this. One of the Iraqi officers I talked to, I asked him how long did he think the fighting would go on. He said he figured about 25 years. So I think, you know, there's some good news there that some of these units are coming along and there's some capable commanders and some dedicated people. The flip side is they still have a ways to go in terms of training and they don't have the numbers.
Well, in the areas that you visited, Haditha, for example, what's the balance of power there between the government troops and the insurgents? I mean, are they making headway?
Well, I think it's pretty well established that there weren't sufficient American forces for the so-called post-war period. We never really entered into a post-war period. It's always all been a continuation of the war. But there weren't enough American forces following the fall of Baghdad. And I was there then. And as a consequence of this, Anbar really became a Wild West region. There weren't enough American troops, for example, to control Fallujah, Ramadi, or any of these areas in the early weeks and months after Saddam fell, and this became a sanctuary for the insurgency. Well, even now, there are not enough American troops in Anbar. It's primarily a Marine mission, but there's some U.S. Army there. And it's what the U.S. military calls an economy of force mission, which I think is just kind of a polite way of saying they're trying to do their best with what they got. And the situation in terms of American force levels is actually going to become worse. And that's because Baghdad has become such a great worry because of the sectarian strife, because of the fear that this could lead to an all-out civil war, that American forces are being diverted from Anbar, which which already doesn't have enough, to Baghdad. For example, military police that would train the Iraqi police or one of the striker units, they're being sent to Baghdad. So the economy of force operation in Anbar is becoming even more of an economy of force.
So what's the consequence of that shortage?
The consequence is that the American forces can maneuver where they want in Anbar, but they can't protect the population against intimidation by the insurgents. If the Americans in Haditha want to go down to Barwana, where there's a small base, or they want to go to this or that place, they can do that and establish kind of control over that area. But the citizens in the Haditha triad are subject to all sorts of intimidation and threats and occasional assassination and murder on the part of the insurgents, and we simply don't have enough forces to protect them. And there's another factor. There's never been enough troops at any one time to protect the entire province. So they're always taking action in one area at the expense of another. Now, here's an example. When they did the Fallujah operation in 2004 to clear out Fallujah, they had to take some forces from the Haditha area just to have enough Marines to clean out Fallujah. Well, the insurgents moved in and executed all the Iraqi police in Haditha on the soccer field. We didn't have enough troops to protect them. So every time they've taken action in Anbar, it's usually created a vacuum in another part of that province which the insurgents have exploited.
Well, Michael Gordon, in your examination of the efforts to train, equip, and staff an Iraqi army in the province of Al-Anbar, in this week's New York Times, you talked to a lot of American military commanders. They say that clearly more American troops are needed, and from your description, it seems clear that there aren't enough troops to provide security. You know, there is another point of view you hear, that putting more troops into the country, particularly in Sunni areas, are an irritant, that they generate hostility and feed the insurgency. What's your sense of that, and the American commander's sense of that issue?
Well, I think there's not a unified view among the American military. I mean, I quote the executive officer of one of the Marine regiments as saying the Marines in Anbar, and particularly in that regiment's area, have asked for more forces, and they don't expect to get them, but they've asked for them just to cover the area that they've been given. I think at the senior levels of the American military with General Casey, I mean, he was, I wrote a story for the New York Times just about a month or two ago. He was projecting a program of troop withdrawals from Iraq this year and next year. And I think at the senior levels, they're more sensitive to concerns in Washington. My own view is that it takes troops to do counterinsurgency. It takes the right type of troops, but it takes a fair number of forces. You hear the administration, the president, Secretary Rice talk about, we have a strategy of clear, hold, build, clear the town of insurgents, hold it with Iraqi forces, and then win the population over by building something good there for them, you know, reconstruction, political engineering. Well, we don't have enough forces to do that in many parts of Iraq. We've done that rather selectively in Tal Afar and certain places, but there are not enough forces to pursue this strategy, which ostensibly is the American strategy in Iraq.
You were in Iraq, I believe, when the fighting began in Lebanon. Do you have any sense of how the Israeli action in Lebanon might affect the dynamics of the Iraqi insurgency and sectarian strife?
Well, I see a connection really going the other way. I think, and this is a bit speculative on my part, but I think there's a connection between the situation the United States finds itself in Iraq and the situation in Lebanon. And this is the connection that I see. You got to step back a few years, and you have to realize that one of the reasons the Bush administration invaded Iraq and carried out regime change, as they call it, was not merely to get rid of Saddam Hussein, but in their mind, the Bush administration's mind, it was to teach an object lesson to Iran, which is pursuing nuclear weapons, to Syria, which has had links with terrorism, to desist from these sorts of activities. It was to have that sort of demonstration effect. I've talked to administration officials. They acknowledge that. Well, it's had a bit of the opposite effect, because Iraq has become such a difficult situation for American forces, and we're so overextended there. And really, Iraq hangs in the balance, you know, years later. And so because of the American difficulties in Iraq, what you find is not only are Syria and Iran not intimidated by the United States, but they're a bit emboldened, and they're taking steps that they didn't take several years ago. And one of those is to support Hezbollah. And so I think to a certain extent our difficulties in Iraq have inadvertently kind of contributed to the situation in Lebanon, because it was Hezbollah that, after all, that essentially started this war.
Michael Gordon is chief military correspondent for the New York Times and co-author with retired Marine General Bernard Traynor of the book Cobra 2, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Michael Gordon, chief military correspondent for the New York Times. He was just in Iraq and is co-author of a book about the 2003 invasion and occupation. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Another Fine Day, the new album by the group of moonlighting musicians known as Golden Smog. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Gordon, is chief military correspondent for the New York Times. He recently returned from Iraq, where he's written about efforts to build Iraqi security forces and stem the violence in Baghdad. He's co-author with retired Marine General Bernard Traynor of the book Cobra 2, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. Well, Michael Gordon, you recently were in Baghdad, and you wrote about efforts to increased security there, and that city so torn by sectarian violence, and that you wrote that there were efforts to plans to bring both American and Iraqi forces from other parts of the country that are hotly contested into Baghdad. Why the emphasis there? Why is it more important, for example, than pacifying the Sunni triangle?
Well, there are really two wars going on. There's the war against the insurgency, which is essentially a Sunni-based insurgency with maybe 10% foreign fighters, and that's the war in Anbar. But there's another war going on, which is a sectarian war. Some people call it a civil war, but whatever you want to call it, there's been a huge escalation in sectarian strife in Baghdad, the capital of the country and the home of some 7 million Iraqis, which is about maybe a third or a quarter of the population. And there are great fears that this could spin out of control and really overwhelm the new government there. Remember Prime Minister Maliki, one of the first things he did when he came in, as he said, he was going to improve the security in the capital through a new security plan. So he put his credibility on the line. Well, that didn't happen. They didn't improve the security. It deteriorated significantly. And so that's the challenge that the American military is trying to cope with now in working also with the Iraqi military.
You said that they used the ink blot strategy here. Describe that.
Well, I think initially what the Prime Minister Maliki did, he said he was going to improve. There's going to be a new Baghdad security plan. They were going to get a control over the city. I mean, a new government, maybe it's understandable it can't control all regions of Iraq, but you would expect it to at least be able to control its own capital. And so what he did, I think, was just create a lot of checkpoints, throw forces on the street. Sectarian violence flared, didn't work, and there are a lot of grisly numbers back that up. The idea now is to do kind of a classic counterinsurgency strategy, which is you'll take an area, you'll take a neighborhood, maybe start with a fairly benign area, flood it with American and Iraqi forces, clean it out of insurgents, house to house, you know, do sweeps, establish a perimeter around it so they can't sneak back in. Once you've got it stabilized, bring in the Iraqi police so they can hold it so you don't lose it when you move on to something else, and then begin to meet some of the basic needs of the people there, essential services and whatnot. Then you move on to another area. That's really the inkblot strategy.
Do you think it's realistic to even using Iraqi forces as those interacting principally with civilians? Is it realistic to think you can go into an area that is where a Shia militias, for example, are embedded and find all the weapons?
Well, if you can't do that, then it's a lost cause. I think the situation in Iraq is people read about it in the news and it seems bad. Well, it is bad. It may even be worse than people realize. And I think at this stage of the game, sometimes people would ask, are we winning in Iraq? No, we're not winning in Iraq. We're just not losing in Iraq. And the kind of discussions you have in Iraq that I had, including with American military officers, is not whether we're winning, because we're not. It's whether it's winnable and at all. And I think we're at a stage of the game where if you can't control the capital and you can't stop this escalating spiral of sectarian attacks, we're at risk of basically losing control of the entire situation. So I think whether this is realistic or not, I think it's our only recourse at this stage of the game.
You mentioned it may be worse than some people think. You know, you do hear some say that reporting tends to focus on the areas of greatest insurgency or sectarian strife, and that I guess the numbers I've heard from some people are that 14 of 18 provinces are relatively stable. What about the argument that by focusing on conflict, we get a misimpression of the situation?
I'm very familiar with this argument as a journalist, and when I was out there in the 2003 timeframe, I did my nation-building stories in Mosul and elsewhere, and it's certainly true that the media does have a tendency to focus on the violence. That said, the absence of security is really the primary problem in Iraq today. That and the inability of the Iraqi government to function as a government, what the U.S. military calls ministerial capacity to do things on behalf of its citizens. I mean, these are the two biggest problems in Iraq today. And if you can't prevent vigilante groups from attacking the population, and if you've got people running around in uniform whose agenda doesn't reflect that of the government, but loyalty to this or that Shiite party, You can't do reconstruction if there's no security. You can't deliver basic services if the policemen are being killed. And you can't call yourself a government if there are areas of the capital that are not under really under the government's control, but under the control of this or that renegade leader. So security and is really the main story, and the big challenge is to establish that security, and also for the Iraqi government to win over its own people by doing things on their behalf. I mean, this is the big test at this point in time. And as for that number you threw out, it's irrelevant. I've heard this, you know, that 14 out of the 18 governorates are relatively peaceful. Well, you know, all that tells me is that in the Sunni-dominated areas, there's a Sunni insurgency and a lot of sectarian strife. The Sunnis are concentrated in four or five provinces, and this is the heart of the country. It's where the capital's located, and it's where all the violence is.
My guest is Michael Gordon. He is chief military correspondent for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining me, my guest is Michael Gordon. He is chief military correspondent with the New York Times. Well, Michael Gordon, your book that you wrote with retired Marine General Bernard Traynor, Cobra II, which tells the story of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, has been described in some as the definitive account of this war, at least as yet. And one of the more remarkable things that you describe in your book was that Saddam Hussein didn't think he would be defeated by the Americans, that he was actually more concerned about Iran and a Shiite uprising from within.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's fascinating about the war is the extent to really both sides misread their opponent and committed very serious mistakes. I was embedded for this war with the Allied Land War Command, so I had a very inside view of how decisions were made and what the strategy was and how it changed in Washington's interventions. And also in the course of working on the book with General Traynor, we came across some classified debriefs of the Iraqi command. So we know what the Iraqis thought in their own words before the war, during the war, and afterwards looking back on it. We put these two together. And one of the things that's very striking, as you point out, is that prior to the war, Saddam was worried about an adversary, and it's the same adversary George Bush is worried about today. It's Iran. He was worried about Iran. And for obvious reasons, Iraq had fought an eight-year war with Iran. Iran, unlike Iraq, is seriously pursuing WMD. Wasn't subject to sanctions. And so that was his big concern, and it had a huge influence on his level of preparedness for the American attack, and also even on the way he handled the WMD issue.
One has to bear in mind that his forces were, you know, ravaged by an American assault in the first Gulf War. Did the way he deployed his military leave him open to an American assault in a different way? Did it leave him unprepared?
Well, you got to remember, the Iraqis look at the situation, they don't look at it through our end of the telescope. They looked at it through their end of the telescope. And, you know, the way the Iraqis were looking at things, and the Americans beat them in the so-called Desert Storm campaign in 91, but they stopped at the Euphrates. They didn't go to Baghdad. They didn't try to perform regime change. And so when he looked back at the lessons of the Gulf War, he pretty much concluded that it demonstrated that the American military was certainly technologically capable, but also as Saddam read past events, he concluded the Americans didn't have the will to go to Baghdad. The Iraqis also thought that their WMD might have played a role. Their view is that chemical weapons were effective in forcing a stalemate in the war with Iran, and Saddam's view and that of his high command was that the notion that somehow Iraq might have WMD could have a deterrent effect against the Iranians, against the Israelis, against their own population, against the Shia, against the Kurds, so that they wouldn't challenge the regime. So as the Iraq war approached, Saddam was trying to walk a very tight, kind of careful line. His strategy was to let the Americans, let the UN inspectors in to check anything, knowing that they would find no WMD. But he didn't want to resolve all the ambiguity over whether he might have some hidden away. He wanted to maintain that because he thought that was necessary for deterrence vis-a-vis his own population and vis-a-vis Iran. He didn't have WMD, but he wanted the world community to think that he just might have it. And of course, the CIA took that and ran in the exact wrong direction and misinterpreted everything and concluded that, in fact, he did have it.
You know, Donald Rumsfeld, the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, of course, had this notion of a different kind of modern American army, one that was smaller, lighter, more mobile, more high-tech. And you write in the course of your examination of this war that at some point before the invasion, he essentially tossed out the principal battle plan, which is this thing whose acronym is pronounced TIPFIDDLE, the time-phased forces deployment list. Why was this significant?
Well, the actual battle plan was actually the central command, which is drew up the battle plan. It was known as 1003. And the plan that Rumsfeld inherited called for about 380,000 forces to take Iraq at a minimum. It was drawn up by General Zinni. And the reason General Zinni envisioned so many forces is he not that he thought it would be hard to defeat the Iraqi military, but because he was concerned with what they call the troop-to-task ratio, how many forces it would take to occupy and secure the country. He really wanted to be able to lock it down. Well, Rumsfeld considered that old thing, the generals always ask for more than they need, kind of a legacy of the Cold War. He was very dismissive of that. And so over a period of interactions with General Franks, they produced a far smaller plan. But then as you correctly point out, as the war approached, and not only did they begin with a fewer number of troops than General Zinni envisioned, but they threw out the army plan, the army kind of plan for introducing reinforcements, which was known as the TIPFIDDLE. It's one of these awful military acronyms, the time phase force deployment list, because Rumsfeld wanted to control all the key decisions about how many reinforcements to introduce and how many not to introduce once the war was underway. He didn't want it to be automatic. And he made a very fateful decision, which turned out to be very ill-advised. As American forces were moving in on Baghdad and taking Baghdad, he canceled the deployment of the 1st Cavalry Division, the last American division in the plan. As small as the force was in Iraq, there was supposed to be one more division, the 1st Cavalry Division, that was supposed to deploy. Well, that division was canceled as Baghdad fell. And it deprived the American military commanders in Iraq of that extra division. And I was embedded with the General McKiernan and the Land War Command then, and they wanted that division. So sometimes it's said at the White House that the commanders in the field got all the forces that they asked for. And that's not factually accurate. The commanders in Iraq in the summer of 2003 wanted the 1st Cavalry Division, and it was canceled following discussions by General Franks and Secretary Rumsfeld.
One of the things you read, it's been widely said that the United States was ill-prepared for the tasks of occupying and pacifying the country once the war was over. You write that, the failure to plan for civil administration was not an accident. Why didn't the Bush administration see this as a big job and an important one?
Right. I mean, the point that General Traynor and I had was that people sometimes say, they didn't have a plan for the post-war, or they forgot about it, or it was an oversight. And that's not really the case. They had a plan. The post-war part was called Phase 4. And they had a Phase 4 plan. They just had a bad plan and an inadequate plan, and one that was based on highly optimistic assumptions. And what happened was the Bush administration entered office with an antipathy toward nation building as a project. They looked at what the Clinton administration had done in the Balkans, And they said, look, you know, we went in there. We still have forces there. The public is still dependent on Western organizations and armies. That's not the way things should be done. And President Bush himself was quite critical of this in a famous speech he gave at the Citadel. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld gave a speech a month before the invasion of Iraq in New York City. And the speech was called Beyond Nation Building. And he said, you know, the way they did it in the Balkans created these unhealthy dependencies, putting all those forces in there. We're not going to do it that way again. I mean, I think their vision was that Iraq was going to be kind of a turnkey operation. We were going to go in there, take down Saddam, take down his army, and then withdraw the vast bulk of our forces very quickly, turn it over to the Iraqis and international community, maintaining some presence there, of course, to control things. And I saw a manifestation of this on April 16th, 2003, a day I won't forget. It was General Franks' first trip to Baghdad, and I was at the Abu Ghraib North Palace, which was the headquarters then. And he came in, this is 1 week after the fall of Baghdad, after that statue came down, and he came in and he told his commanders that they should be prepared to withdraw all but one American division, plus a few odds and ends, by September 2003. This was the Bush administration vision. It was supposed to be an in-and-out war, and that's what they planned for. And when it didn't turn out that way, when it turned out there was an insurgency, they were very, very slow to react.
You write at the end of your book, Cobra 2, that the determination of American forces to fill the void left by civilian policymakers and to engage the Iraqis as well as fight the insurgents has kept alive the hope of an outcome that would justify their sacrifice. A few months have passed. Do you still see hope that this is going to work?
I personally think it's premature to call this a failure, but it's certainly become far more difficult, far more costly than anybody ever envisioned. I think that what's going on in Baghdad now with this new Baghdad security plan is absolutely essential. And, you know, if the Iraqi government, in partnership with the Americans, can't regain control over their own capital, then I think we're going to be in a very difficult situation. But I think we have to wait and see how this effort goes in Baghdad over the next several weeks and months before drawing any firm conclusions about whether this is going to be viable or not. So I'm still trying to hold out hope that it can be something can be salvaged from this. But, you know, at the White House, they call this the strategy for victory. And I think that really victory has been redefined over the past several years. I mean, originally, victory was we defeat Saddam, we get most of our forces out of there, over to them, what a former diplomat called the ding-dong, the witch is dead theory of regime change. You know, we knock out the wicked witch, the munchkins are happy, we get in the hot air balloon, maintain a division, of course, to keep an eye on things, but we do this with kind of low cost. Then the insurgency rose up, and victory became, well, we defeat the insurgency. And then we're back on track with our plan. Well, they still call this the strategy for victory, but there is very little chance that we're going to defeat this insurgency in the near term. So what victory means at this stage of the game is we, over the next months and years, hand over the primary responsibility for fighting this insurgency to the Iraqi security forces. We stay there in some capacity to help them do this. They manage to protect the government in Baghdad, which gradually expands its authority, and this fight goes on for years and years. That's what victory means at this stage in the game, and the debate is whether we can achieve even that.
Well, Michael Gordon, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Michael Gordon is chief military correspondent for the New York Times and co-author with retired Marine General Bernard Traynor of the book Cobra 2. He has a piece in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine about troubled efforts to recruit and train Iraqi security forces. Coming up, Ken Tucker on the latest album by Golden Smog. This is Fresh Air. Golden Smog is a side project for veterans of rock bands such as Wilco, the Jayhawks, Soul Asylum, and lesser-known groups. Golden Smog has put out three albums since 1992, and the group's new fourth collection, called Another Fine Day, got rock critic Ken Tucker thinking about the pleasures and perils of musicians moonlighting from their day jobs.
That's the title song from Golden Smog's album Another Fine Day, on which Gary Louris, former member of the Jayhawks, sings in an attractive moan about the not-so-fine day he's having. Like a lot of the music Golden Smog makes here, it's very pretty and very melancholy. This persistent paradox, woeful beauty, dominates all of the subjects and styles on which these musicians have chosen to collaborate.
Well, I saw you at the station. It was after the election. Downcast, they were calling. Your behavior was appalling. At the feet of the blessed, your hair burned my hand. Are you happy where you are? Well, I knew.
In the 60s and 70s, you had supergroups like Cream and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Sometime after that, the concept became open, like everything else in the culture, to irony and commercial opportunism. We can hold out the Traveling Wilburys as an artistically successful latter-day supergroup. You can't get any supergroupier than having Bob Dylan and a Beatle in your band. But Golden Smog's origin bands, like Jeff Tweedy's Wilco, Gary Louris' Jayhawks, and Craig Johnson's Soul Asylum, each individually started out as homage music to musicians and groups they admired. Wilco and the Jayhawks, for example, wouldn't have existed without Dylan or Graham Parsons or the band. Golden Smog music is often good, but it's also never strikingly original. Is it any wonder that one of the catchiest songs on this new album was originally commissioned, though never used, as a car commercial?
That song, Corvette, is striking for its verve on an album of mostly mid-tempo ruminations. And its recurring lyric, "The dream is never over," is entirely fitting for a song meant to inspire you to achieve your dreams by buying a new car. But it's a rare bit of optimism in Golden Smog's Clouds of Melancholy. More typical is a song such as You Make It Easy, in which the singer says he can't imagine himself with any other lover other than the one he's addressing, even as the tone of his voice suggests that this may also be the most depressing notion he's ever had. Also, please note this layered, rather Traveling Wilburys-esque chorus.
I want you to understand. I'm gonna be your man. You make it easy. You make it easy. Yeah.
Although the 15 songs here fade off in quality along about number 12, Another Fine Day is another fine Golden Smog album. And like all Smog, Wilco, Jayhawks, and Soul Asylum albums before it, it also makes you want to pull down older music by the older musicians they remind you of for a hit of what inspired them.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Another Fine Day by the group Golden Smog. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Where do I go? What do I see? See many people coming after me. So where are you going to? I don't mind. If I live too long, I'm afraid I'll die. So I
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Where Soldiers Fear to Tread, a relief worker's tale of survival in war-ravaged Somalia by John S. Burnett. From the Annenberg Fund for Excellence in Communications and Education. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tommy Chong of the comedy duo Cheech and Chong. His new book is The I Chong, Meditations from the Joint. And we remember actor Bruno Kirby, best known for playing Billy Crystal's best friend in the comedies When Harry Met Sally and City Slickers. Kirby died Monday. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.